81, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. This morning we're going to listen to a little bluegrass music. The roots of bluegrass can be traced to the Scottish and English settlers who brought it to Appalachia in the 18th century. But when Appalachian migrants fled the mountains for the cities following the Second World War, Baltimore became, for a time, the capital of bluegrass. And some of the finest practitioners could be heard in bars and in home jam sessions all around town. One of the breakout groups of the 1950s was the Stony Mountain Boys, a Baltimore group who became the first bluegrass band to appear in Carnegie Hall. Here's a little more of their take on the classic Rollin' in My Sweet Baby's Arms.
They say your parents don't like me. They drove me away from your door. If I had my life to live up, I'd never go there anymore.
On Sunday night, Tim Newby, a Baltimore-based author and historian, will host a launch party and concert for his new book, which chronicles the history of bluegrass. The book is called Bluegrass in Baltimore, The Hard Drivin' Sound and Its Legacy. Tim Newby joins me in the studio. Good to meet you.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be here today.
So Baltimore became pretty attractive to folks coming from Appalachia after the Second World War. Why?
For work. There was lots of factories here, Martin Bonner Factory, Bethlehem Steel, and they needed work. They needed, you know, a city that was close. And lots of cities at the time, Cincinnati, Dayton, some of those kind of Midwest area cities had the same attraction, but Baltimore really, Bethlehem Steel was massive at the time and employed a lot of people. So just kind of proximity to as well. It wasn't very far for some of them. So it made sense.
So you wrote that in the 1950s, Baltimore was the place where city met country. You quote a songwriter named Hazel Dickens. We'll talk about her in a little bit. That she saw signs for rent that said no dogs or hillbillies. How were the Appalachian migrants received?
Not very well. They kind of seemed to cluster in little neighborhoods around the city, right outside the city, like Dundalk and Middle River and stuff. Some smaller areas in their neighborhoods, and they weren't very well received. They were looked down upon. Lack of education, the way they spoke, you know, just the image of the, you know, hillbilly Appalachian migrant, you know, barefoot with a corncob pipe type thing. So they definitely were not very well received at all, except by people who liked the music they brought with them. And that was what made Baltimore really unique.
You talk about this very vibrant scene in the 50s and 60s in particular. Where did this scene happen? These weren't concerts. Where were the venues that people could hear bluegrass?
So there's probably really two places where it happened. There were the corner bars, which still like there is in Baltimore today. There's a, you know, a bar in every corner. A lot of them were there, and you figure men after work would come home, and they played, and they would go there and gather. But then there was a really vibrant house scene, too, that was gathered around a couple different houses, and sometimes those would be some students who were maybe attending college around here, Towson, Hopkins, stuff, who just had an interest in this music, and they kind of would befriend some of these, you know, migrant musicians and start playing there. And so you had a really neat kind of mix of these folkies who only knew the music from what they had learned and read, and these people who had learned it kind of, you know, as their roots, kind of coming together and playing. So really that the houses and these corner bars, but yeah, it wasn't big concerts like we would think of today.
Yeah, but it was pretty pervasive. It was sort of all over town.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, it was a good scene. Bands could make a decent living playing, you know, 5, 6, 7 nights a week, or, you know, Russ Hooper, who's, been around forever in Baltimore, kind of, you know, used to talk about playing, you know, 8 shows a day and stuff and things like that, where, you know, these bands would go and they'd play a radio show and then they'd play, you know, a bar here and play up at New River Ranch or something. So they were constantly playing, you know.
Yeah. You talk about a guy named Mike Seeger. Yep. He's Pete Seeger's half-brother. He's the first guy to produce a full-length bluegrass album. That was in 1957.
Yep.
The term bluegrass didn't really even come around until the 50s.
Yeah, I think there's the perception that it's this extremely old music. And while it has its roots there, the term bluegrass, some people said it was a feud word. It kind of comes from Bill Monroe, who's kind of the godfather of bluegrass music. And, you know, he kind of took some of the old folky type music and music he'd heard back home in Kentucky and kind of sped it up with his mandolin. And his band was Bill Monroe and his Bluegrass Boys. Well, in his band, he had Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs, who, when they were there, they kind of really were the ones who defined this sound. Well, they had an ugly split with Bill Monroe and Flatt and Scruggs. And when Flatt and Scruggs would go to play, people didn't want to say play those Bill Monroe songs. So they would say, play those bluegrass songs. And it kind of started from there, and it slowly over time kind of caught on. At one point, Bill Monroe says that what I do is not country, it's bluegrass, to kind of solidify what he feels he was doing. But it was a very slow evolution of the word. It's not, you know, it didn't just come out that way.
That's a tune called Cindy. This comes from this album that Pete Seeger did. How did this album come about? This was done on the Folkways Records label. What are the circumstances that led to it?
So Mo Ash, who was kind of the founder and who ran Folkways Records, knew his brother Pete. And he knew that Mike had been teaching Pete how to play some banjo. And there was an interest kind of in this folk revival movement of people getting to banjo. And Mike happened to have a connection because he was from Baltimore and had a little access to kind of the real, you know, music. It wasn't like a bunch of people in New York sitting in their apartment cross-legged playing. He knew these people. So Mo offered him a chance at, hey, here's $100. Do you want to make an album about banjo? Because there's an interest. And Seeger jumped all over it. So he kind of drove around. He took like a week-long trip down to the South Virginia, North Carolina to go visit some of these banjo players. And then he kind of relied on his friends back in the area. Dickie Rittler, who was playing on Cindy, and Bob Baker, and some of the people he knew. He kind of got a chance to record some of the legendary people, but then said, I got to fill this album out, so Baltimore's got these great musicians. Let's take advantage of them, and they're my friends, and they'll do it for real cheap, you know?
And he's a good player, too. This is Mike Seeger playing along with Bob Baker. Bob Baker went on to found a band called the Pike County Boys. That's a little clip from a tune called Groundhog. He really knew what he was doing. He wasn't just a recording engineer.
Yeah, absolutely. And Bob Baker kind of has the first working bluegrass band in Baltimore. And it was Bob Baker on guitar and singing. It was Mike Seeger originally on fiddle. Mike Seeger could play everything. It was Hazel Dickens on bass, Dickie Rittler on banjo, and then Bob Shanklin on mandolin. And they were really the first bluegrass band that was working in Baltimore, playing, and whether they were getting paid a lot or getting paid a little, they were kind of the first ones to be doing it, going down to places in Fells Point, the Blue Jay, and stuff like that.
Tim Newby is my guest. His new book is called Bluegrass in Baltimore, The Hard Drivin' Sound and Its Legacy on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Tim, tell us about Alan Lomax. He's a pretty important figure in this evolving history.
So he had been living over in Europe after there had been accusations that he was a communist, and he kind of figured, let me get out of town. Went over to Europe, and when the air kind of cleared, he came back, and he had always loved this very rural sound, and, he always kind of, like he said, he loved the war whoops, the very rural sound that was coming out of, Mississippi and the South and stuff. And he wanted to put on a sound or a show to kind of highlight this. So he was trying to get different types of music. He got a rock and roll band. He got some blues bands. Muddy Waters was there. And he wanted to get a bluegrass band to play.
So this is for a concert that he produced at Carnegie Hall
yep.
in 1959.
Yep, it was called the Folk Song 59 Festival at the Carnegie Hall. And he wanted to get Bill Monroe, and Bill Monroe, who was, not very left-leaning at all, thought, I don't want to deal with this guy. So he kind of turned him down. And then he thought, well, after him, Flatten Scruggs. Well, he made the mistake of not calling Louis Scruggs, who was the manager of them, and he never heard back. Well, he was friends with Mike Seeger. Mike Seeger knew of this band in Baltimore, Earl Taylor and the Stony Mountain Boys, and introduced him, and Alan Lomax said, let's get him up here.
Yeah, so they ended up being the first bluegrass band to play Carnegie Hall.
Yep, yep.
Yeah.
Fire on the mountain!
Let's talk about women in bluegrass. You write about several of them. Ola Belle Reed, she ended up playing the White House in 1977. A woman named Hazel Dickens, mm-hmm. we mentioned her a couple times. She played bass with Bob Baker, Alice Gerard. Here's a clip of Alice Gerard and Hazel Dickens, a tune that they recorded in 1973 called Tiny Broken Heart.
He was just a little farm rat, so big.
So did women play a prominent role in the evolution of bluegrass here in Baltimore and elsewhere?
With Alice and Hazel, yes. And when they came about, they were really something to be seen. Women weren't harmonizing with each other. There wasn't really, you know, necessarily women taking the lead. And when the two of them met at a house party in Baltimore, they kind of realized that their voices really meshed. You had Alice's kind of really, like, low, husky voice, and you had Hazel's really powerful voice that was kind of colored with, like, the dirt from the coal mines kind of thing that really gave some authenticity to it. And their voices really meshed. And so you had two women singing lead harmony together, which you didn't always have. So it was something to kind of be seen. And they had a really slow evolution. They didn't immediately say, hey, we're doing this. They played at house parties. And Hazel was pretty shy at first. So it took a little while, but eventually they did. And they recorded a few albums. And it was something really amazing to hear two women kind of taking the lead and taking charge and singing that way.
Yeah, they sound great together. You talk a lot about the modern influences, the influences that bluegrass had on modern bands like Jerry Garcia, the Grateful Dead, Phish, you know, these jam bands and stuff.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, with people these days, Chris Jacobs, who used to play in the Bridge and now plays solo, you know, kind of said that the Bridge, which you would never confuse as being a bluegrass band, wouldn't be around if it wasn't for that kind of music. There's something there. I mean, an honesty and a simplicity in playing, and a lot of these guys, they pay attention to that, know that, and while it's not what they do now, they've definitely taken from it. They don't play in a traditional sense, but there's a, you know, a foothold they have in there that's really important to what they do now.
Yeah, and Caleb and Chris will be part of the event that you're having at the Creative Alliance.
So yes, absolutely.
Let's talk about a really wonderful, gracious guy named Del McCoury.
The man.
Who is still playing. He's in his late 70s. There's a Del Fest every Memorial Day weekend here in Maryland. Tell us about his importance.
So Del started out, he didn't actually live in Baltimore. He lived up in southern PA. But Baltimore really at the time had this flourishing bar scene and house party scene, and Mike Seeger was around recording. So people were definitely traveling here to play, and Del was one of those people. Del was originally a banjo player, and he was playing with Jack Cook over at the Chapel Cafe, which is over on the corner of Pratt Street and Chapel, just kind of south of Hopkins. And Jack Cook had played with Bill Monroe previously. And we got to kind of remember that this is in, you know, 1963. This is pre-cell phones and emails. So Del said one night he was playing there and he kind of sees a guy come walking in and doesn't really recognize him. And Del's brother Jerry was also in the band, and both of them kind of realized that, like, that's Bill Monroe. Like, why is he here?
Bill Monroe, the father of bluegrass.
Yeah, yeah, the Bill Monroe. And he said that they had no idea he was going to be there. And he came backstage and was talking with Jack, and it turned out he had a show in New York and he needed some people to play with him. And he was going to take Jack along, and he needed a banjo player, so he took Del along. And Del started playing with Bill Monroe, and that kind of was really how he got his big break out of Baltimore, was, you know, just that kind of that lucky break of Bill Monroe knowing Jack and needing a couple players.
And God bless, he's still playing, Del.
He is. He still plays and is the nicest man around. And when he plays, is the big smile on his face. And he's just as happy now as he was back in, you know, 1963 at the Chapel Cafe.
Yeah, good for him. You also write about a guy named Walt Hensley. And he had an album back in 1969 called Picking on Newgrass. Is Newgrass a sort of new, what was it at the time, a new derivation?
And it was. And it's funny because some bands kind of picked up on that. And that's not, you know, the only place it came from. That term had been thrown around a little bit. But that was maybe the first time you see it on an album. Sam Bush definitely says that there was a huge influence on him. And while the name had been kicked around a little bit, that kind of solidified that, hey, it's Newgrass Revival is going to be the name of this band that's representing something.
That guy, Walt Hensley, he can play. I mean,
he was unbelievable.
Yeah.
One of his biggest fans is somebody who you probably wouldn't think of as in the bluegrass, was Jerry Garcia. Jerry loved Walt Hensley playing. And Jerry's friend Sandy Rothman, I spoke with a lot for the book, and he couldn't tell enough stories about how much him and Jerry loved Walt, and Earl Taylor, for that matter, like those guys from Baltimore, which is kind of a weird connection. They're out on the West Coast, but they were a huge influence on what they did there.
Yeah. There have been a couple of Charm City Bluegrass Folk Festivals held in Druid Hill Park in 2014, and then just this past April. Looks like that's a pretty established thing. That's going to happen every year.
It is. Jordan August and Phil Chorney, the two guys who put it on, really wanted to kind of highlight that Baltimore is still a vibrant scene, and to also kind of make people aware of the history they had. So I think they've just finished their third year. They're getting ready for their fourth year, and it's great. They, you know, they incorporate Caleb and Chris and guys like that, but then they also reach back. Last year, the Traveling McCurries, which is Del's son's band, played. So there's like a nice, you know, kind of full circle coming there. So they're doing a great job of really keeping the music alive and reminding people how important Baltimore really was in this kind of music.
Well, Tim, I really appreciate your coming by and bringing these very, in many instances, very rare recordings.
Yes, absolutely.
A lot of fun, the book and all the tunes. So thanks so much.
Well, I appreciate you having me here. It's been a great time.
Tim Newby. His new book is called Bluegrass in Baltimore, The Hard Drive and Sound and Its Legacy. He'll be launching the book on Sunday night at the Creative Alliance in East Baltimore with musicians Caleb Stein, Chris Jacobs, and many, many others. We'll have a link to more information about the book and the book launch concert on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. More ahead on Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
I had a dream the other day. I'm getting ready to go. Now the devil came and he took me away. I'm getting ready to go. Sweet home, loving heaven.